has withstood the storms of time, so there the Palantir of that tower has remained. But alone it could do nothing but see small images of things far off and days remote. Very useful, no doubt, that was to Saruman. Yet it seems that he was not content. Further and further abroad he gazed, until he cast his gaze upon Barad-dûr. Then he was caught.
Who knows where the lost stones of Arnor and Gondor now lie, buried or drowned deep? But one at least Sauron must have obtained and mastered to his purposes. I guess it was the Ithil stone, for he took Minas Ithil long ago and turned it into an evil place. Minas Morgul it has become.
Easy it is now to guess how quickly the roving eye of Saruman was trapped and held, and how ever since he has been persuaded from afar, and daunted when persuasion would not serve. The biter bit, the hawk under the eagle's foot, the spider in a steel web. How long, I wonder, has he been constrained to come often to his glass for inspection and instruction, and the Orthanc stone so bent towards Barad-dûr that, if any save a will of adamant now looks into it, it will bear his mind and sight swiftly thither. And how it draws one to itself! Have I not felt it? Even now my heart desires to test my will upon it, to see if I could not wrench it from him and turn it where I would, to look across the wide seas of water and of time to Tirion the Fair, and perceive the unimaginable hand and mind of Fëanor at their work, while both the white tree and the golden were in flower. He sighed and fell silent.
"I wish I'd known all this before," said Pippin. "I had no notion of what I was doing."
"Oh, yes, you had," said Gandalf. "You knew you were behaving wrongly and foolishly, and you told yourself so, though you didn't listen. I didn't tell you all this before, because it's only by musing on all that has happened that I've at last understood, even as we ride together. But if I'd spoken sooner, it wouldn't have lessened your desire or made it easier to resist. On the contrary, no, the burned hand teaches best. After that, advice about fire goes to the heart."
"It does," said Pippin. "If all the seven stones were laid out before me now, I should shut my eyes and put my hands in my pockets."
"Good," said Gandalf. "That is what I hoped."
"But I should like to know," Pippin began.
"Mercy," cried Gandalf. "If the giving of information is to be the cure of your inquisitiveness, I shall spend all the rest of my days in answering you. What more do you want to know?"
"The names of all the stars, and of all living things, and the whole history of Middle-earth, and over heaven, and of the sundering seas," laughed Pippin. "Of course, what less? But I'm not in a hurry tonight. At the moment I was just wondering about the Black Shadow. I heard you shout, 'Messenger of Mordor.' What was it? What could it do at Isengard?"
"It was a black rider on wings, a Nazgul," said Gandalf. "It could have taken you away to the Dark Tower."
"But it wasn't coming for me, was it?" faltered Pippin. "I mean, it didn't know that I had..."
"Of course not," said Gandalf. "It is 200 leagues or more in straight flight from Barad-dûr to Orthanc, and even a Nazgul would take a few hours to fly between them. But Saruman certainly looked in the stone since the Orc raid, and more of his secret thought, I do not doubt, has been read than he intended. A messenger has been sent to find out what he's doing. And after what has happened tonight, another will come, I think, and swiftly. So Saruman will come to the last pinch of the vice that he has put his hand in. He has no captive to send. He has no stone to see with, and cannot answer the summons. Sauron will only believe that he is withholding the captive and refusing to use the stone. It will not help Saruman to tell the truth to the messenger. For Isengard may be ruined, yet he is still safe in Orthanc. So, whether he will or no, he will appear a rebel. Yet he rejected us, so as to avoid that very thing. What he will do in such a plight, I cannot guess. He has power still, I think, while in Orthanc, to resist the Nine Riders. He may try to do so. He may try to trap the Nazgul, or at least to slay the thing on which it now rides the air. In that case, let Rohan look to its horses. But I can't tell how it will fall out, well or ill for us.
It may be that the counsels of the enemy will be confused, or hindered by his wrath with Saruman. It may be that he will learn that I was there, and stood upon the stairs of Orthanc, with hobbits at my tail, or that an heir of Elendil lives and stood beside me. If Wormtongue was not deceived by the armour of Rohan, he would remember Aragorn and the title that he claimed. That is what I fear. And so we fly, not from danger, but into greater danger. Every stride of Shadowfax bears you nearer to the land of shadow, Peregrine Took. Pippin made no answer, but clutched his cloak, as if a sudden chill had struck him. Grey land passed under them.
See now, said Gandalf, the Westfold dales are opening before us. Here we come back to the eastward road. The dark shadow yonder is the mouth of the Deeping Coombe. That way lies Aglarond and the Glittering Caves. Don't ask me about them. Ask Gimli if you meet again, and for the first time you may get an answer longer than you wish. You'll not see the caves yourself, not on this journey. Soon they will be far behind.
I thought you were going to stop at Helm's Deep, said Pippin. Where are you going, then?
To Minas Tirith, before the seas of war surround it.
Oh, and how far is that?
Leagues upon leagues, answered Gandalf. Thrice as far as the dwellings of King Theoden, and they are more than 100 miles east from here, as the messengers of Mordor fly. Shadowfax must run a longer road, which will prove the swifter. We shall ride now till daybreak, and that is some hours away. Then even Shadowfax must rest, in some hollow of the hills. At Edoras, I hope. Sleep, if you can. You may see the first glimmer of dawn upon the golden roof of the House of Eol. And in 2 days thence you shall see the purple shadow of Mount Mindoluin, and the walls of the Tower of Denethor white in the morning. Away now, Shadowfax! Run, Greatheart! Run as you have never run before! Now we are come to the lands where you were foaled, and every stone you know. Run now! Hope is in speed! Shadowfax tossed his head and cried aloud, as if a trumpet had summoned him to battle. Then he sprang forward. Fire flew from his feet. Night rushed over him. As he fell slowly into sleep, Pippin had a strange feeling. He and Gandalf were still as stone, seated upon the statue of a running horse, while the world rolled away beneath his feet with a great noise of wind.
Book 4 Chapter 1 The Taming of Smeagol.
"Well, master, we're in a fix and no mistake," said Sam Gamgee. He stood despondently with hunched shoulders beside Frodo and peered out with puckered eyes into the gloom. It was the third evening since they'd fled from the company, as far as they could tell. They had almost lost count of the hours during which they had climbed and laboured among the barren slopes and stones of the Emyn Muil, sometimes retracing their steps because they could find no way forward, sometimes discovering that they had wandered in a circle, back to where they had been hours before. Yet on the whole they had worked steadily eastward, keeping as near as they could find a way to the outer edge of this strange, twisted knot of hills. But always they found its outward faces sheer, high and impassable, frowning over the plain below. Beyond its tumbled skirts lay livid, festering marshes, where nothing moved and not even a bird was to be seen. The hobbit stood now on the brink of a tall cliff, bare and bleak, its feet wrapped in mist, and behind them rose the broken highlands, crowned with drifting cloud. A chill wind blew from the east. Night was gathering over the shapeless lands before them. The sickly green of them was fading to a sullen brown. Far away to the right, the Anduin, that had gleamed fitfully in sunbreaks during the day, was now hidden in shadow. But their eyes didn't look beyond the river, back to Gondor, to their friends, to the lands of men. South and east they stared to where, at the edge of the oncoming night, a dark line hung, like distant mountains of motionless smoke. Every now and again a tiny red gleam far away flickered upwards on the rim of earth and sky. What a fix, said Sam. That's the one place in all the lands we've ever heard of that we don't want to see any closer, and that's the one place we're trying to get to, and that's just where we can't get nohow. We've come the wrong way altogether, seemingly. We can't get down, and if we get down, we'll find all that green land a nasty bog, I'll warrant. Phew, can you smell it? He sniffed at the wind. Yes, I can smell it, said Frodo, but he didn't move, and his eyes remained fixed, staring out towards the dark line and the flickering flame. Mordor, he muttered under his breath. If I must go there, I wish I could come there quickly and make an end. He shuddered. The wind was chilly and yet heavy with an odour of cold decay. Well, he said, at last withdrawing his eyes, we can't stay here all night, fix or no fix. We must find a more sheltered spot, and camp once more, and perhaps another day will show us a path. Or another and another and another, muttered Sam, or maybe no day. We've come the wrong way. I wonder, said Frodo. It's my doom, I think, to go to that shadow yonder, so that a way will be found. But will good or evil show it to me? What hope we had was in speed. Delay plays into the enemy's hands, and here I am, delayed. Is it the will of the Dark Tower that steers us? All my choices have proved ill. I should have left the company long before, and come down from the north, east of the river and of the Emyn Muil, and so over the hard of battle plain to the passes of Mordor. But now it isn't possible for you and me alone to find a way back, and the orcs are prowling on the east bank. Every day that passes is a precious day lost. I'm tired, Sam. I don't know what's to be done. What food have we got left? Only those, what you call 'em, lembas, Mr. Frodo. A fair supply. But they're better than naught by a long bite. I never thought, though, when I first set tooth in them, that I should ever come to wish for a change. But I do now. A bit of plain bread and a mug, aye, half a mug, of beer would go down proper. I've lugged my cooking gear all the way from the last camp, and what use has it been? Not to make a fire with for a start, and not to cook, not even grass. They turned away and went down into a stony hollow. The westering sun was caught into clouds, and night came swiftly. They slept as well as they could for the cold, turn and turn about, in a nook among great jagged pinnacles of weathered rock. At least they were sheltered from the easterly wind. "Did you see them again, Mr. Frodo?" asked Sam, as they sat, stiff and chilled, munching wafers of lembas in the cold grey of early morning. "No," said Frodo. "I've heard nothing and seen nothing for 2 nights now." "Nor me," said Sam. "Grr! Those eyes did give me a turn. But perhaps we've shaken him off at last, the miserable slinker. Gollum! I'll give him Gollum in his throat, if ever I get my hands on his neck." "I hope you'll never need to," said Frodo. "I don't know how he foddered us, but it may be that he's lost us again, as you say." "In this dry, bleak land we can't leave many footprints, nor much scent, even for his snuffling nose." "I hope that's the way of it," said Sam. "I wish we could be rid of him for good." "So do I," said Frodo. "But he's not my chief trouble. I wish we could get away from these hills. I hate them. I feel all naked on the east side, stuck up here with nothing but the dead flats between me and that shadow yonder. There's an eye in it. Come on. We've got to get down today somehow." But that day wore on, and when afternoon faded towards evening, they were still scrambling along the ridge and had found no way of escape. Sometimes in the silence of that barren country they fancied that they heard faint sounds behind them, a stone falling, or the imagined step of flapping feet on the rock. But if they halted and stood still listening, they heard no more. Nothing but the wind sighing over the edges of the stones. Yet even that reminded them of breath softly hissing through sharp teeth. All that day the outer ridges of the Emyn Muil had been bending gradually northward,
as they struggled on. Along its brink there now stretched a wide, tumbled flat of scored and weathered rock, cut every now and again by trench-like gullies that sloped steeply down to deep notches in the cliff face. To find a path in these clefts, which were becoming deeper and more frequent, Frodo and Sam were driven to their left, well away from the edge, and they didn't notice that for several miles they'd been going slowly but steadily downhill. The cliff top was sinking towards the level of the lowlands. At last they were brought to a halt. The ridge took a sharper bend northward and was gashed by a deeper ravine. On the further side it reared up again, many fathoms at a single leap. A great grey cliff loomed before them, cut sheer down as if by a knife stroke. They could go no further forwards, and must turn now either west or east. But west would lead them only into more labour and delay, back towards the hearts of the hills. East would take them to the outer precipice. "There's nothing for it but to scramble down this gully, Sam," said Frodo. "Let's see what it leads to." "A nasty drop, I'll bet," said Sam. The cleft was longer and deeper than it seemed. Some way down they found a few gnarled and stunted trees, the first they had seen for days. Twisted birch for the most part, with here and there a fir tree. Many were dead and gaunt, bitten to the core by the eastern winds. Once, in milder days, there must have been a fair thicket in the ravine, but now, after some 50 yards, the trees came to an end, though old broken stumps straggled on almost to the cliff's brink. The bottom of the gully, which lay along the edge of a rock fault, was rough with broken stone and slanted steeply down. When they came at last to the end of it, Frodo stooped and leaned out. "Look," he said, "we must have come down a long way, or else the cliff has sunk. It's much lower here than it was, and it looks easier, too." Sam knelt beside him and peered reluctantly over the edge. Then he glanced up at the great cliff rising up, away on their left. "Easier," he grunted. "Well, I suppose it's always easier getting down than up. Those as can't fly can jump." "It would be a big jump still," said Frodo. "About, well," he stood for a moment, measuring it with his eyes, "about 18 fathoms, I should guess, not more." "And that's enough," said Sam. "Ah, how I do hate looking down from a height! But looking's better than climbing." "All the same," said Frodo, "I think we could climb here, and I think we shall have to try. See, the rock is quite different from what it was a few miles back. It has slipped and cracked." The outer fall was indeed no longer sheer, but sloped outwards a little. It looked like a great rampart or sea wall whose foundations had shifted, so that its courses were all twisted and disordered, leaving great fissures and long, slanting edges that were in places almost as wide as stairs. "And if we're going to try and get down, we'd better try at once. It's getting dark early. I think there's a storm coming." The smoky blur of the mountains in the east was lost in a deeper blackness that was already reaching out westward with long arms. There was a distant mutter of thunder borne on the rising breeze. Frodo sniffed the air and looked up doubtfully at the sky. He strapped his belt outside his cloak and tightened it, and settled his light pack on his back. Then he stepped towards the edge. "I'm going to try it," he said. "Very good," said Sam gloomily. "But I'm going first." "You?" said Frodo. "What's made you change your mind about climbing?" "I haven't changed my mind, but it's only sense. Put the one lowest as is most likely to slip. I don't want to come down atop of you and knock you off. No sense in killing two with one fall." Before Frodo could stop him, he sat down, swung his legs over the brink, and twisted round, scrabbling with his toes for a foothold. It is doubtful if he ever did anything braver in cold blood, or more unwise. "No, no, Sam, you old ass," said Frodo. "You'll kill yourself for certain going over like that, without even a look to see what to make for. Come back." He took Sam under the armpits and hurled him up again. "Now wait a bit and be patient," he said. Then he lay on the ground, leaning out and looking down, but the light seemed to be fading quickly, although the sun had not yet set.